Well, good morning, everyone. Hi. Come on in and join us if you are visiting outside or visit more quietly. Glad to have you all here this morning. I'm Jason. I'm one of the deacons here at the church, and we are in the middle of nearing the end of kind of an interesting series that we've been doing called A Time for Everything. And this comes to us from the book of Ecclesiastes, which was, there's a section in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes that tells us that there's a time for everything under heaven. There's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to laugh and a time to cry. I tend to think of it lyrically because it came. We think of it in terms of the bird song from, I think, the 1960s that came out. But we have this beautiful writing that there is telling us that there really is a time for everything under heaven. What we just heard about, what we heard Pastor Mike up here talking about, there's a time to die. That's hard for us to understand. And there's a time to be born. And this is a recognition of the rhythms of life that we exist in, right? I think Pastor Rob has said that this shows us, this book of Ecclesiastes shows us what does living under the sun look like for us. And I would encourage you to continue to read through the whole book of Ecclesiastes, but also meditate on the first 8 verses of chapter 3, which tell us about these things. I was just talking to Mark Anderson a little bit ago, and we were talking about the heaviness of a lot of these verses, and today will be no different. Today we're going to be talking about a time to tear and a time to mend, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but this deals with some hard stuff. What you'll also see is there's similarities between other things that we've talked about. I think the last time that I taught, I taught on there's a time to weep and a time to laugh. And we see similarities. We see this contrast between hard things and good things, or what seem like hard things and good things. And so today it's going to be no different. We're going to kind of touch on some of those things, kind of walk through this. One of our goals, as folks who've been teaching, you've heard from 4 of us now this summer, that we've tried to keep in sight, is that we want to talk about what is God trying to teach us through each of these passages that we're looking at. What is God trying to tell us in each of these cases? And then, in light of that, what do we do with what we're hearing from God? So what I want to do is open us in prayer, then we're going to kind of jump off and getting into this passage. So join us in prayer. God, thank you for this morning. I am so grateful for a place where we can gather, where we can worship together. It's an amazing gift, God, that you give us, that through the rhythms of life, that we have this place that we can come and fellowship and be with one another. And that you, God, you tell us you're present here. And I pray that you help us to recognize that, to love you well, to bring glory to your name, and to love one another as well. I pray this in your name. Amen. So, when you hear in the Bible this idea of there's a time to tear, it always refers to the concept of suffering. When it refers to tearing in the Bible, it's always in response to breakdown, to loss, to things not working like they're supposed to. This is going to be one of the places where you're going to see some similarities with my last teaching, because the last time I taught, when I talked about weeping and laughing, I talked about the tendency towards disintegration. We respond to the world being disintegrated, that it's not working like it's supposed to. And that's what we see here as well when we think about there being a time to tear. And there's a lot of ways that this happens in the Bible. We can identify a whole bunch of them. I have it listed up here. There's it's always a response to suffering, but it can be suffering in a number of different ways. Most commonly, probably, has to do with relational loss. And again, we can look at lots of places where this is the case. I just want to mention one of them, just to kind of bring you into this, to see what does the Bible say about this. And so in 2 Samuel, right at the opening of 2 Samuel in the first chapter, we read here that David has heard of the death of the king of Israel. He's heard of the death of King Saul. Now, Saul was the first king of Israel. Saul, much of the time, really didn't like David at all. In fact, was trying to kill David much of the time. But he was the first king of Israel. Along with this, Saul's son Jonathan, who was one of David's best friends, has also been killed. And David, upon hearing this news, responds in such a way. It says in verse 11 of 2 Samuel 1, it says, "Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him, and they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." So there's this recognition of loss, this recognition of relational loss. There's a recognition of death. And one of the responses in the context of that was to tear one's clothing. Another word that's been used is to rend one's clothing. There's a tearing that occurs. Tearing also occurs in response to physical suffering, to physical pain. And we see that in the story of Job. And as Tom mentioned, we're going to be talking a little bit more about that here in a bit. So I won't go into that now, but this tearing can happen in response to physical suffering. It can also happen in response to material losses. Again, in the story of Job, which we're going to be visiting this morning, there can be a sense of disintegration, a sense of loss, a sense of mourning over losing things materially. But again, we'll get into that here in a bit. There's also a sense of loss, a sense of breakdown, in response to a remorse over sin. Some of you may be familiar with the story of King Josiah. King Josiah was a very young king. He became king when he was 8 years old, king of Israel. And in his mid-20s, they were doing some work in the temple, which had fallen into disrepair. And one of the people had found, while they were working in the temple, they found the book of the law. They found scripture. They found it, and they read it aloud. And they brought it to the king and read it to him. And the king's response upon hearing the words of the law, when he recognized how far they had fallen from God's plan, it says he tore his clothes. The king tore his clothes in remorse over the national sin of Israel, over the rejection of God's plan. And a few verses later, this is in 2 Chronicles 34, at verse 26, it's talking about they went and sought out the advice of Huldah, who was a prophetess. And she says, "To the king of Judah," so Josiah, "but to the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of the Lord, thus shall you say to him, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, regarding the words that you have heard, because your heart was tender and you humbled yourself before God, when you heard his words against this place and its inhabitants, and you have humbled yourself before me and have torn your clothes and wept before me, I also have heard you, declares the Lord." And so there's this response, this response to remorse over the sin of Israel. And so, again, there's a sense of this isn't how things are supposed to be. This isn't the way God designed it. Finally, we see that tearing of clothes happens in response to a rejection of God's plan. In the book of Numbers, we read that Moses has sent a group of spies into the promised land to scout out the promised land and see what's there. And the spies come back, and Joshua and Caleb, two of them, say to Moses and to the people of Israel, "This land is amazing. This land is really something. It's flowing with milk and honey. Basically, this place is incredible." And the people, and they say, "But there are people there that we're going to have to deal with. There are lots of very strong people in the land that we're going to have to deal with." And the people of the nation of Israel hear this, and they say, "Would that we had stayed in Egypt. It would have been better for us if we had never left slavery. Would that we die. They're stronger than we are. We cannot go up against them." And so they raised a loud cry, and they wept. And Joshua and Caleb hear this, and their response is to respond very strongly to that. Beginning in verse 6 of Numbers 14, it says, "And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, 'The land which we pass through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones, but the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of the meeting and to all of the people of Israel." So Joshua and Caleb are responding to this rejection of God's plan. And they respond by tearing their clothes. So again and again in the Bible, when we read of the tearing of clothes, when we read about someone tearing their clothes, it's always in response to a sense of loss. It's always in response to mourning. It's always in response to suffering. So when you read that in Ecclesiastes 3, when it says there's a time to tear, it means there's a time to mourn. There's a time to suffer. So there's a time to experience that. There's a recognition that this isn't how life is supposed to be. There's a recognition that this is disintegrated. When you hear the word integration, integration means things that are together. So something that is disintegrated means things are torn apart. And without exception in the Bible, when you read about this tearing, it's in response to that. It's a grief response. And God is very good at giving us physical pictures. When most of you, I think, can probably imagine taking something and tearing it. There's a very physical picture of something ripping apart, of being taken from its natural state to an unnatural state. And so it gives us a picture of something being destroyed or damaged or not how it's supposed to be. Now, earlier, we were able to hear from Pastor Mike up here talking about the loss of Jameson and Catherine and their three little ones. Right? That's not how it's supposed to be. We hear of losses like that, and it makes no sense to us. It doesn't make sense to us that this is that a young family on their way to do mission work in Japan should die. Tragically, it makes no sense. It's hard to wrap our brains around that. That's a time for the tearing of clothes, right? In the Old Testament, had that happened, that would have been a time when people would have shown that physically by the tearing of their clothes. There's a real sense of tearing in the Pals family, right? Desmond and Lydia, little Desmond and Lydia, will never grow up with their cousins. They will never get to know their aunt and uncle. That part has been torn from them. But God in the book of Ecclesiastes tells us, you know what, there is a time for tearing to happen. And we see this in response to all sorts of physical suffering. We see this in response of losing loved ones, of broken relationships, of material losses, of physical damage. Everywhere we see examples of this tearing that's happening. It happens all around us. And so this is a part of life under the sun. This is a part of life in a broken world. Now, I want to mention just briefly, there's something when you do a study of tearing in the Bible, there's something that some of you, probably most of you, are unaware of. And that has to do with the high priest. The high priest of Israel was the top of all the priests in Israel. He was the one who was the representative of the people to God, right? He was the mediator between God in Old Testament times. Now the high priest was, according to the Levitical law, according to the Old Testament law, was forbidden to tear his clothing. He was not allowed to show this physical response to remorse. It says that in Leviticus 21 that he was not allowed to let his hair hang loose, and he was not allowed to tear his clothes. Now, in Leviticus 10, Aaron is the high priest. Aaron was Moses' brother. Aaron was the high priest of Israel. And it says in Leviticus 10, starting at verse 1, it says, "Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, 'This is what the Lord has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified.' And Aaron held his peace. And Moses called Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Uzziel, the uncle of Aaron, and said to them, 'Come near, carry your brothers away from the front of the sanctuary and out of the camp.' So they came near and carried them in their coats out of the camp, and Moses said, as Moses had said. And Moses said to Aaron and to Eleazar and Ithamar, his sons, 'Do not let the hair of your heads hang loose, and do not tear your clothes, lest you die and wrath come upon all the congregation. But let your brothers, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning that the Lord has kindled.'" So there's a very specific instruction here to the high priest. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, have just died unexpectedly. And Moses speaks to this. And one of the things he says is, "Now, Aaron, don't tear your robes. Don't express grief over this. As a nation, we will mourn this. As a nation, we will mourn this suffering. But you, Aaron, are not allowed to do this. Do not express grief." Why? Because the priest, the high priest to the nation of Israel, represented a better hope. He represented a higher hope. As Christians, we believe Christ has come and revealed that better hope to us. We live in a different place now than what they did then. We live in a place where Christ has come and redeemed us. And we live in that reality. In 1 Thessalonians 4, Paul is writing to one of the churches. Now, as Christians, we're often called a priesthood of believers. And listen to this. In 1 Thessalonians 4:13, Paul says to them, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep," in other words, those who have died, "that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep." So we mourn, but we mourn like those who have hope. We don't mourn like those who have no hope. The world we live in, apart from Christ, has no hope. And we mourn, but we don't do it like those who have no hope. If you get a chance, talk to Chris or talk to Karen. You will see a picture of a family who's mourning, but not like those who have no hope. They recognize a greater purpose in what has happened. And that happens because of Christ. As Tom mentioned, I wanted to spend a little bit of time in the book of Job. And if you're unfamiliar with the book of Job, let me just kind of give a little bit of background. So Job was a man who was called blameless and upright. It says he feared God, he shunned evil, he did what was right in the eyes of God. He was materially wealthy, but it did not appear to go to his head. He regularly prayed for his children, prayed for his children's hearts. And so we have this picture of what seems like a pretty amazing man, right? And so we learn about him a little bit at the beginning of the book. And early on in the book, Satan comes into God's court, right? It's a little weird to me, but Satan comes into God's court and is talking with God. And God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? He's blameless and upright," right? And Satan responds by saying basically, "Well, of course, everything is going right for Job. Of course he honors you. Of course he glorifies you because everything about him is going right." And he says, "If you took that stuff away, Job would curse your name." And God says, "Okay, I'll allow you to take the stuff from him, but don't touch Job." And so in one fell swoop, we learn that Job's livestock are killed. Job's servants, most of them, are killed. All of Job's 10 children are killed. This is tragedy upon tragedy in the life of Job. And yet he does not curse the name of God. In chapter 2, Satan doubles down. He comes back and he's talking to God again. And God says, "See, he's held his righteousness." And Job responds by saying, Satan responds to God by saying, "Well, of course, he still has his health." And God says, "Okay, you can touch his health, only don't kill him." And so in the next wave, Job is covered with great sores. So he's experiencing material loss. He's experiencing mourning over the loss of loved ones. He's experiencing physical suffering. All of these things I said earlier, we see when there's expression of mourning. Now in Job 1:20, we read this. We read, "Job arose and he tore his robe and he shaved his head and he fell on the ground and he worshiped." It's amazing. He worshiped in the midst of this tragedy. In the midst of mourning, he offered worship to God. That's not our typical mindset when we think about mourning. We think it's somehow distant from God, but Job worships in the midst of that. In the next chapter, in chapter 2, three of his friends are coming by. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are coming by. Why don't we use those biblical names anymore? I know there's lots of kids that are going to be born. Just let me toss out those as a few ideas. So his friends come and they see Job from a distance. And it says when they see him, they raised their voices and they wept. And they tore their robes. So there's a sense of shared mourning between Job and Job's friends. And Job's friends said nothing for 7 days. I've heard it once said that the best spiritual care Job's friends ever offered was during those first 7 days when they kept their mouths shut. There's a lot of wisdom in that. And for the next several chapters, we see this dialogue between these four men, between Job and his three friends. And Job is defending himself. He's defending his righteousness, and his friends are pushing back harder and harder upon him, saying, well, you must have done something wrong. Something must have happened. And so we see this building and building and building. And we see this pushback upon Job. And they're trying to process, they're trying to deal with, how do you make sense of such unbelievable suffering? In fact, when we hear, when we think of people suffering, we often point them to the book of Job, right? I mean, we tell people, you want to read about suffering, this is a good spot to go, is the book of Job. And so there's a real honest, I think Tom even hinted at this, a real honest wrestling with suffering. Finally, well, not finally, but later in chapter 32, one of my favorite characters in the Bible shows up. It's a young guy named Elihu. And I wish we actually did more work on this young guy, because I don't think we know a whole lot about him. Elihu is a young guy who's apparently been here for some time talking with Job and his, or listening with Job and his friends, but he doesn't say anything because he's a young guy and he knows it's best to hold his tongue. And finally, he gets to the point where he's like, I've got to say something. I have to speak to this. And so he shows up in Job 32. And he begins to challenge these men. He begins to exhort or rebuke Job for the words that he's offered. And as I was studying, I came across this part in Job 33. There's a section from verse 12 to verse 30 that I want to spend a little bit of time on. Just kind of walking through and see if you see what I see. I'm going to share with you what I've seen. Go wrestle with it. I think it's good stuff for us to wrestle with. So this is Elihu. He's speaking to Job. Starting at verse 12, he says, behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying, he will answer none of man's words? For God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, while they slumber on their beds, then he opens the ears of men and terrifies them with warnings, that he may turn man aside from his deed and conceal pride from a man. He keeps back his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. So in verse 14 there, it says, for God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. When I read that, I'm reminded that God is in the business of doing things that don't make a whole lot of sense to us. God is often doing more things than we are ever capable of seeing. If you believe, as we do, that God is infinite and you are not, if you believe that God is perfect and you are not, it's very reasonable to assume that he is doing things that don't make a whole lot of sense to you. I think so often we look at suffering, we look at pain, we look at mourning, and we assume that it means that God isn't good. We assume that it means God is somehow angry at us, or that God hates us. That somehow we've done something to offend the nature of God. Maybe we have. But God is in the business of doing things that don't make a whole lot of sense to us in the meantime. And at those times we have to trust that God knows what he's doing. We learn to trust in the character of God, who reveals himself as loving. We're not capable of seeing everything he's up to. It's arrogant to think that we are. Continuing on, starting at verse 19, it says, man is also rebuked with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones, so that he loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near the pit, and his life to those who bring death. It's a picture of physical suffering, right? I mean, early on in the book of Job, we read about how he's lying on the ground covered in painful wounds. But I think if you've ever talked to someone who's seriously depressed, this idea of physical pain accompanies it. It accompanies depression. There's a sense of the soul drawing near the pit. There's a sense of loathing bread. You lose your appetite when you're very much down. And so this accompanies mourning. Continuing on, verse 23. He says, if there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand to declare to man what is right for him, and he is merciful to him, and says, deliver him from going down into the pit. I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor. A mediator, a friend, comes alongside and is able to help the person, is able to walk alongside the person to see what is right. He is able to pray that the person may be restored. He's able to walk alongside this person and let his flesh become fresh with youth, right? A person's able to remind of the movement of God. Verse 26, it says, then man prays to God and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy, and he restores to man his righteousness. He sings before men and says, I sinned and perverted what was right, and it was not repaid me. He has redeemed my soul from going down into the pit, and my life shall look upon the light. The man in pain, through the mediation of a friend, the prayers of a friend, is able to recognize the face of God. It's in suffering a lot of times that we begin to see the face of God and respond with a shout of joy. Because the man, the suffering man here, knows that he's been redeemed by God. Just a couple more verses, starting at 29, it says, behold, God does all these things twice, three times with a man to bring back his soul from the pit, that he may be lighted with the light of life. Elihu reminds Job that these things can happen maybe again and again. Why? So that we might see the face of God. Suffering has a purpose. God will do whatever is necessary to conform us to his image. He will do whatever is necessary to help us love others well. He will do whatever is necessary to make us more like him. Suffering has a purpose. I came across a recent prayer in Larry Crabb's most recent book that I've been trying to pray regularly. And it says, listen to this. It says, whatever the cost, make me a little Christ. Father, may your spirit open the eyes of my heart to see your beauty so that I am left with no greater desire while I live in this world than to reveal your son's love to others by how I relate. Whatever the cost. Are you willing to pray that? Are you willing to say to God, whatever the cost? I mean, to lose a family member, to lose a relationship, to experience physical suffering, are you willing to say, God, whatever the cost, make me more like you? Are you willing to say, make me more like your son? God, open my eyes so I can see how beautiful you really are, so that I am left with a desire to glorify you and love others well. Job was able to see the beauty of God in a way that he had never seen before. At the end of the book of Job, in Job 42:5, Job says to God, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. God allows suffering so he can mend. He allows suffering to bring us more deeply in connection with him. So we have almost no time left to talk about mending. And I think that's okay. We'll get through this. Without God, without a belief in a creator of the universe, We believe that the universe is just slowly winding down. More and more rips are occurring. More and more tears are occurring. Meaninglessness factors in everywhere until everything stops. Without God, everything is meaningless. But remember, as Christians, we don't mourn like people who have no hope, right? We have hope. We believe that what has been torn can be mended. I want to point out a couple of things. God is a restorer. God, Psalm 147 verse 3 tells us that God binds up the wounds of the brokenhearted. When you experience suffering, God himself tends to those wounds. 1 Peter 5:10, Peter is writing and he's telling the saints, he's saying, the devil's prowling around. And you're going to experience this, just like saints, just like the joined church all around the world is experiencing this sort of suffering. And then he says, after you've suffered a little while, God will restore you. So the response to suffering is God's restoration of us. I love this in Revelation 21:5. We are reminded by God himself. He says, behold, I am making all things new. He's making a new creation. He's restoring relationships. He is restoring each and every one of us. And we see that at the end of the book of Job, that God has restored Job. He restores much of Job's material fortune, but more importantly, he's given Job eyes to see him. God is not mean-spirited. Everything God does is driven by love. Everything God does, everything God allows, is meant to draw you closer to him. God isn't fickle. He's not doing this because he's a mean-spirited kid. If you're experiencing suffering, God has a purpose in allowing that. God takes his time to bind up our wounds. God, remember, God tears so that he can mend. Nate, can you put up that picture of that bowl? It's kind of interesting that we're talking about Japan. And the Palses were going to go there to be missionaries. There's a tradition in Japan where if a bowl becomes broken, if a piece of pottery becomes broken, they mend it with gold. Why? Because when God mends something up, he makes it even more beautiful than what it was before. So God is in the process of restoration. God is in the process of mending, but he also invites us as the church, as part of the world, to be involved in part of this process. He asks us as believers to be part of this, getting involved by donating things to the Palses, praying for the Palses, looking around you. There are hurting people all the way around you right now. Recognizing that and responding to that is part of what we're called to as a church. In Galatians 4, I think you can go to the next slide, Nate. In Galatians 4, one of my favorite verses, Paul says, I'm in the pains of childbirth until I see Christ formed in you. Part of our role in one another's lives is to see Christ formed in one another, right? We're called to do that in one another. Later on in Galatians 6, he tells us, he says, brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. And then later he says, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Right? We bind up one another's wounds. We tend to one another's wounds. Mending happens in community. We are called a body of believers. Maybe a good way to think of it is many of you have probably seen tapestries, which are large fabric pieces of art. And there's all sorts of different threads that, when put together, show real beauty. Right? And they're bound together. I was thinking about this, and I was going to actually do this physically, but Heather said you wouldn't be able to see it from the stage. So I was going to bring up a single piece of thread and show how easily it breaks. She said, they're not going to be able to see that. So you're going to have to just imagine with me, use your imaginations. But you take 1,000 of those little threads and weave them together, and that is a really hard piece of fabric to tear. Because we function best when we're together, when we're woven together with one another. Later on in the book of Ecclesiastes, in Ecclesiastes 4, verses 9 to 12, the writer says, two are better than one because they have good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. We function best together. So practically, what does that look like? Just quickly, stay in fellowship with each other. God designed the world to work, designed his church to work together. And sometimes we're going to rub up against one another. And there's a tearing that will happen, but mending also happens here. Pray for one another. Spend time bringing your petitions before God on behalf of one another. So that's vertically. Horizontally, try and join people. Don't try and fix people. So often our tendency is to want to try and fix what's wrong. But join them. We are walking a road together. We are walking a road on this earth together. Don't be so quick to offer solutions. Be quick to listen. This, I think, happens best in small groups. One of Cedar Creek's core values is we value small groups. We're in here, and you get a couple hundred people between here and the other side of the wall where there's probably 1,000. There's not 1,000. But we get a lot of kids over there and a lot of adults in here, and it's hard to make those deep connections, but that can happen in small group. My small group has 4 couples and a bunch of little ones. And we join together and we pray together and we read together and we laugh together and we sometimes share meals together and we struggle together. Why? Because that helps us to mend. It helps us to tear and to mend with one another. We were on the radio on Monday. We've been doing this radio show. And one of the other people on the radio said that these churches, these small groups, should provide accountability without shame. And I loved that idea, that we're able to confess to one another. But we don't bring shame to one another. We confess to one another and receive the forgiveness of Christ. And then finally, we look together toward the greater movement of God. Remember, God is doing things that don't make a whole lot of sense to us, maybe. And when we walk together on that road, we begin to see the amazing things that he's doing. Let's pray. God, it's a heavy, heavy section we're working through this summer, I think, at times. But God, you reveal your beauty there as well. I'm grateful for the tearing, even when it's hard. God, I'm grateful for the mending. I'm glad, God, that you tend to our wounds. I pray that every person here would experience your careful attention to their pain, that you weep with those who weep, God. I just pray that as we go forth from here, we have eyes to see you and hands to join with one another. Pray this in your good name. Amen.